You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello and welcome or welcome back to another episode of Black Hair in the Big Leagues. I'm your host, Alicia Thomas. And you guys, my heart is Twitter-pated today. I am meeting a new friend and already being on the line with them. Their personality is so infectious and they're so fun, and I'm so excited to get to know them with you all as well. So let's see here. My guest today is a playwright with, this is so casual, degrees from Princeton University, Middlebury College, and Northwestern University. And this is my very first non-binary guest. Their writing has been seen on Broadway for Circle in the Square's reading series, off-Broadway, and beyond. They currently serve as an associate producer for a Book of Queer on Discovery Plus, and their current play, Lavender Men, will premiere this fall in Los Angeles. Y'all, please help me welcome Roger Q. Mason!
Salisha Chow, you are fabulous, darling. I love your energy. I love just everything about the enthusiasm and the joy that you have for our people telling our stories in New York and beyond. I think it is so important for us to remember that this is about the joy of storytelling. We are the original griots.
Come on.
We are an oral tradition. We are a community-based people, and we are a naturally storytelling people. That is how we have always made our way in the world. That's how we've understood each other and our relationship to the world. We, Black people, just in case any of the listeners weren't clear on what we're talking about, we are the inventors of Western drama. And see, a lot of people don't know this, but
Let's go.
So when I was in undergrad with two of, I know one of these folks you've met before, Liliana Blaine Cruz.
Yes.
And I was also in undergrad with the wonderful Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. Mm. And the three of us at some point during our careers at Princeton studied with Michael Cadden, who was one of the, my understanding is that he was the dramaturg for August Wilson when he was developing some of the earlier parts of the Pittsburgh cycle at Yale School of Drama and also the O'Neill. One of the books that we read, I will never forget, was Oscar Brockett's History of the Theater. And in the very beginning of the book, in a tiny couple of paragraphs, on the side, in the corner, in the dark, because we don't want to tell nobody.
Come on.
They talk about the ancient Egyptian ritual of Ast and Asar, which they would call Isis and Osiris.
What's that?
The Isis and Osiris myth is the idea, is basically the myth of Isis and Osiris, who were two siblings slash lovers. And nasty. So we had sibling slash lover gods in ancient Egypt who, you know, Isis's husband, named Set, was off at war, and she needed somebody to, you know, bake her some bread.
Uh-oh.
So while her husband was out of town, she had Osiris to bake her bread. Well, one day they was baking a whole lot of bread, and Set came home while the oven was open.
Uh-oh.
And so he decided he wasn't going to take that because he was fighting a war to protect his wife and the sanctimony of his family. And so he decided to kill Osiris and spread his body all over Upper and Lower Egypt. And the only part of him that he hid, slash destroyed, slash nobody could find, was Osiris's phallus. So Isis goes all over.
Wait, what's the phallus?
Honey, you know what that is.
I'm just asking for clarification for my guests.
Oh, well, we'll put it to you this way. It is a certain organ that exists below the belt in folks that I identify are masculine identified.
Is it hot in here?
Child, you know what? If you can't take the heat, get out the kitchen.
Come on.
So she, this Isis, is so in love and so dedicated to the spiritual love. This is the original original song, Star Love. You know that song by Cheryl Lynn, Star Love? This is the original Star Love. She goes all up and down Upper and Lower Egypt and puts this man's body back together.
Oh.
And so every spring, I believe, the Upper and Lower Egyptians would come together and reenact this myth of Osiris's remembrance as a way of signifying the unity and the mutual story of that nation and its identity. And that myth then becomes, in a way, sort of the Hades myth, in some ways, this idea of dismemberment and resurrection translates into, Judeo-Christian myths later on. The Greeks in their time acknowledge the debt that they owe to the ancient Egyptians for these ideas of storytelling as a group activity, as a community-based unifying activity. Now, we gonna fast forward to the Brooklyn Museum that I just visited a couple of weeks ago, where they have a fabulous exhibit on ancient Egypt in which they acknowledge the erasure of the Africanist understanding of ancient Egypt. And they also specifically acknowledge the erasure of the connection that the ancients had between ancient Egypt and its contributions to Western thought and religion. So now I stand here, a Black artist, a Black queer artist, looking back on the wealth of knowledge, the wealth of spirit, the wealth of community that our people have always contributed, that in times of old, they have understood the debt that they have to pay culturally to us. Yet somehow, when we start inventing race as a socioeconomic system of exploitation, we start forgetting who made the stew. Because if I told you that a nefertitious culture, a Nubian culture, a Black culture, if I told you that so many of your ideas came from Mother Africa, that so many of the values that some folks, I won't say all, but some folks now use to justify bias, exclusion, comfort, erasure, that in fact they are exploiting and abusing ideas that came from Mother Africa herself. That would completely dismember and destroy their understanding of themselves and their sense of being in the world. And let me tell you this, Alicia, if my mission is anything as a writer and as a performer, it is to disrupt, dismantle, and deconstruct the biases and structures that folks have used to separate us so that they can make money off of everybody's ass and lie in the process.
Oh my, I have so many chill. Who, where did you come from, Roger? Seriously.
You know what, child? And it's interesting because this story relates to that. I am originally from Santa Monica, California, which is our big beach town here in LA. And it's interesting, that origin story, because when I was growing up, and of course now, you know, folks moving around and the gentrification of LA, there's no longer this same relationship to real estate apartheid that existed when I was growing up. But when I was growing up in the late 80s and early 90s, and I said, I'm from Santa Monica, folks would be confused because the connotation of Santa Monica was that that was an exclusivist white and white bread town. Uh-huh. And what do you mean you are from Santa Monica? So right. By just saying that I am from that place, I have dismembered a certain definition of what it means to be from there. I have created new meaning and new senses of belonging to that place. And I learned very early on that because of my various liminalities, because I am somebody who is Black, Irish, and Asian, because I'm somebody who's non-binary, because I'm somebody that's pansexual, because I'm somebody that's plus size, I live in various liminal spaces that elude definition and certainly elude the binary understandings of the world that are used to control and define people. And I knew from very early on that those definitions would not serve me and that my purpose in life was to completely reimagine the world just by being.
When did you get that? When did you...
It's been a long suffering and a long process of self-doubt and ultimately self-love to get to that point. You know, there are aspects of me that just understood that within the last 3 months. Mm. There are parts of me that understood that when I moved to Chicago in 2014 to start Northwestern and saw a, you know, gender non-binary bathroom for the first time.
Wow.
There are parts of me that found that out when I was in bed with a man and started crying, you know, crying for joy, for what I could give to somebody.
Wow.
So there are parts of that that I learned in the rehearsal halls of New York and, you know, here in Los Angeles. I learned it through my grandmother used to say, every moment is a teachable moment.
Mm. Roger, I am looking at you as a grown adult who is a disruptor, who is unapologetic, who is on fire for life and for your purpose, who has a purpose, who knows their purpose. It's exciting. And I'm trying to figure out, what was 5-year-old Roger like? Who was that person?
Wow.
Same person, or was it completely different?
You know what? 5-year-old Roger and 12-year-old Roger were two different people. And 36-year-old Roger had to reconvene with both of them. Mm. And it's interesting that you're talking about this, because that was actually, I believe we're having a bit of a psychic connection right now. Because it was at about 5 years old that I found myself, and that self was silenced.
Oh.
So yes, child, we're going there. So I was, my grandmother, Doxy Darlinghaus Mason on my dad's side, was a specialist in early childhood education. She came to LA in the mid 40s and worked in various schools in South Central Los Angeles and identified in that time period that kids were suffering from malnutrition and also a lack of a supportive learning environment. So she was part of the pilot program that would later become Head Start, the National Literacy and Learning Program with Lyndon Johnson's office. She was one of a few folks, including Mary Lou Tolbert and Rosalie Turner, who piloted that program here in Watts at Ritter Elementary School. So she had seen in the 60s, the 70s, and the early 80s, the perils and the pitfalls of underfunded public school education. And even though she dedicated her career to reforming public school education for Black and Brown people here in LA, when it came to my education, she and her friend Mabel Calhoun at the time said, she said, baby, go ahead and send that child over to Pilgrim School. Because at that time, it was known as one of the most culturally diverse schools in mid-city Los Angeles. Now, it has a very storied history related to the conservatism of Los Angeles, because in the 50s and 60s, that was where Strom Thurmond would come and do all of his sermons for, quote, Great America.
Oh.
And this was where they had a boycott on phonics in the 60s. And this was where they had a series of lawsuits in the 60s and 70s about young kids who were, you know, Black and Brown trying to get into this school. And they were dealing with how do they adjust. So by the time the 80s had come along, they were living in the aftermath of that. But, you know, racism's fog is quite thick. Oh, so here I was.
I can't see.
We can't see.
I can't see.
And sometimes we can't breathe.
Oh.
Mm. Now, dang. I went to that school. I started there in either 1988 or 1989. I had come from the YMCA. And when I got to the school, I was in their preschool program. They had a mandatory nap system.
Oh.
And, you know, we had taken me out of the YMCA because they were just having us play patty cake. And my grandmother wanted me to actually have a pre-kindergarten education. And she sent me to this elementary school.
Okay.
Half the day we were napping. So I got
half
up.
Half the day.
Child. So here I am about 4 years old. And I said to the teacher, I said, ma'am, I have to ask you. And I said it similar to this. My grandmother is paying you to teach, not make me sleep.
Uh-oh.
Why are we napping all day?
Oh, four-year-old Roger. Oh my gosh.
Don't you know they held me back till I was five? What? Until I comported with the napping policy.
What?
That and doesn't so, make... So think about this, Alicia. Here I am between 4 and 5 years old learning that my voice is dangerous, that it is going to be silenced, and that I'm going to have to use it to defend my ideas and the ideas that are contrary to the status quo. I learned all of that between 4 and 5 years old.
Oh.
This was my formative social educational moment. Now, I went through, you know, elementary and middle school continuing to be bullied and gender policed. And you know, because I would say that I was always non-binary because I never felt comfortable, you know, with male identifying students. The closest equivalent I could find was to hang out with female identifying students, but they didn't quite understand me because I existed in a space betwixt and between. So by the time I got to 12-year-old Roger, I was very constricted.
Yeah.
And that person sort of stayed through high school while I was trying to find my way into theater, first as a performer, because, you know, what I really wanted to do was sing the blues.
Come on.
That was what I wanted to do. But part of this gender policing program that I was in was, you know, my family at the time was worried about, you know, the infectious nature of homosexuality, you know. So I'd get taken out of the shows. And I tell this story because I think it's instructive of how I came back, because I felt most free at that point. when I was the boy soprano singing in these contests and getting into these shows.
Let's go.
And, you know, and that was where I think up until the recent times, I had my most free and unapologetic relationship to artistic expression. So the process of the 25 years from that moment till now was really reconnecting with the civil belligerence of the five-year-old and the unapologetic freedom of the 12-year-old, and figuring out when along the way I was socialized to feel that those people were wrong and worthy of silencing. Because somewhere along the way, those folks were told no. And it took 20 some odd years to get back to yes. And I'll tell you what part of it was.
Wow.
2019, I was in New York again. And I was working on a piece of mine that would later be called The Pride of Lions. And it's a 1928 play about five female impersonators who were about to have their Broadway debut in Mae West, The Pleasure Man, until the Vice Police shut the show down. And it's a mood, honey. I love that play. And for those Broadway producers out there listening to this, we are ready for a premiere, darling, because that is one fierce ass play.
Let's go. Well,
we're doing a reading of it. Michael Alvarez was directing, and we were doing a reading of it at the Flea in 2019 with a residency with Hook and Eye Theater. And we had a character in the piece called Molasses Jones, and she was a Harlem sister who originally from Tallahassee, Florida, who was not going to sing for no white man unless you paid her, especially the pigs.
Uh-oh.
So we tried everybody, but that was the year that every Black actor gratefully was employed. That was the year that Strange Loop was beginning. That was the year that Slave Play was on Broadway. That was one of Alicia Harris's projects was up at that time. So we were certainly in vogue, and we've stayed in vogue since that time, because we as Black folks have insisted on being seen and heard and valued.
Yes.
But that was sort of that moment, that turning point. They had several articles about it. The new Black playwright, I remember that moment. And so everybody was booked. So
yes!
Michael turns to me and he says, "We've got 3 weeks until we open." I said, "Yeah." He says, "So go online and buy yourself some size 14 shoes, because you're going on, sweet thing."
Oh.
And so there I was, Molasses Jones.
Oh my
God. Writing the play while donning the bejeweled turban and tunic to be the character. And something clicked in me.
What?
I write to elicit joy for the performer.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere along the way of trying to legitimize myself as a man of letters in our merit-based, literary consumed relationship to playwriting, which I think we don't necessarily write exclusively literary work, we write blueprints for performance.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere along the way, I had maybe lost my joy for performing. And that's what the script is. It's a blueprint for performance, and getting up there and clicking those heels and wearing that turban, it just reignited my relationship to playwriting. And so everything that I've worked on since then, in many ways, has been in the learning afterglow of the joy of that moment. And my current play, Lavender Men, It came after, you know, Pride of Lions. It's funny, the story of Lavender Men. Lavender Men is a bit of an accidental, happening.
What do you mean?
Well, I had the pleasure of meeting quite a few folks. One of them was a lovely young producer named Rachel Shuey, who was working at Circle in the Square to give Broadway caliber readings of emerging work. And so there I was, I had just done Pride of Lions. We had an excerpt from the piece that we did, an extended excerpt. And I just closed the second production of my play, The White Dress, which is a genderqueer coming of age piece that's sort of based on this story of that 5-year-old, the 12-year-old, and all of these things. So I was heading back to LA, and this is about July. And so Rachel calls me on the phone. She says, "Where are you?" I said, I'm getting on a plane. I'm going home to Los Angeles. And she said, "Well, come back." I said, "What?
What? Wait, what? I'm getting on the plane."
I said, "I'm on the plane, darling. What are you talking about? Get back." And she said, "Well, I've got a gig for you." I said, "Where?" She said, "On Broadway." I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, I'm doing a program at Circle in the Square. It's called Circle Reading Series. We're providing readings for emerging playwrights and their work. Let me get you an early spot in here, because I know the going's good right now and everything's hot. So let me put you in." And so I had suddenly a gig in August, about 3 weeks later.
Okay.
And so now I was originally headstrong on doing Pride of Lions because I love that piece and I'd spent so much time with it, but there wasn't enough time to do a read of that. So I said, "Oh Lord, what am I gonna do?" So I had a reading of another play of mine called Lavender Men that I had been developing in Los Angeles with Skylight Theater in their playwrights lab. And at that time, the piece was largely about Lincoln's queer relationship with his legal secretary, Elmer Ellsworth. And it was inspired largely by a lot of the work that Paula Vogel does. One of the sort of parent texts for it was Desdemona, a play about a handkerchief, because that's so much about the story that we don't see on stage. And so this idea of private moments and hidden history was always interesting to me. So I had this piece where this, you know, belligerent so-and-so named Taffeta goes, "Well, you see these two? I'm gonna tell you a story about them. They don't like me because, you know, because white queer America doesn't see Black girls." And then that was the beginning. And then she disappears. And then we have a series of scenes about this very romantic love affair. And then she comes back at the end and says something chicken shit nasty and gets off the stage. So we did a reading of it in Los Angeles. And they said, "Well, you know, we need to understand why Taffeta is here."
Okay.
And I said, "Taffeta's here in order to try and insert herself into a love affair where she's not welcome. And she has to learn that she needs to find her own jewels and not be chasing after the affirmation of white love." Mm. And this was the same year that Jeremy was doing Slave Play and that
it's
Michael-
2019?
It's 2019. I'm thinking about the same things. I'm thinking about the same things, but I'm looking at the origins of it. Where does white exclusivism start? Well, it starts with narratives like Abraham Lincoln's, "Pull myself up by my bootstraps, and because I'm white and entrepreneurial, that makes me the superior being." That's where that myth starts, you know? Then from that, you can start to disagree with, you know, reparations. You can start to disagree with affirmative action. You can start to disagree with diversity programming. You can start to disagree with all of those things because you feel like you're justified and fortified in the myth that everybody's equal. And that because I pulled myself up by my bootstraps,
whoa, Roger,
as a member of the white proletariat, and I have this myth to buttress me, I can therefore do whatever I want. And guess what? You can, and flippantly you can say, and you can do the same. Well, we don't talk about systemic racism. We don't talk about job inequality. We don't talk about wage inequality. We don't talk about all the factors that actually don't level the playing field.
Right. Right.
So then I said, okay, well, that's why Taffeta's here.
Whoa.
Taffeta is here to disrupt. So my creative, I call him my creative husband, Lovell Holder.
He's the director?
No. Yes, the director of the play, and he's also my creative producer. We're joined at the hip. And so Lovell throws me a play Homebody Cobble, Tony Kushner's piece. And he says, just read this for an understanding of narrator interruptions. How can you use narration or fourth wall address to disrupt the romanticized vision of white queer love or white male on male love that is going on in the middle of this piece? Where can Taffeta start inserting herself in order to show the iniquities of that system and its exclusion of her? And so that's how we sort of used the 3 weeks before that reading to do the rewrites on it. And we then took that version to New York, and we were just, yeah, go ahead, baby.
Taffeta is in Lavender Men.
Taffeta is Lavender Men.
Got it. Okay.
Lavender Men is the co-producer of this piece, John Lawrence Rivera, who's a very important Los Angeles-based Filipino-American director, has championed, you know, writers of color in LA for many years, alongside the artistic director of Skylight Theater, whose name is Gary Grossman. The two of them are sort of pillars of new play development in LA. And John refers to this piece as a solo show with a couple of white boys in the back making love. You know, and I think it's interesting to frame it that way because, you know, I think about when have I been seen as the love interest? Hmm. When has somebody, you know, genderqueer, Black, multiracial, plus size, ever been the subject of somebody's desire? Mm. You know, Monique said it, honey, who gonna make me feel good at night?
Right?
We never got an answer to that question. We're still searching for the answer to that question. So my motivation behind writing Lavender Men is to still prod that question. It takes the socio-political, but it makes it very deeply intimate. And very tender and very personal, because I think so much of the violence that gets enacted in the streets starts in the homes and the bedrooms where we are our most earnest and vulnerable selves. My grandmother used to say, you are who you are when nobody's looking.
Whoa. Ooh.
You are who you are when nobody's looking. So I'm always interested in looking at intimacy as a microcosmic cross-sampling of our true social problems. How we treat each other in that space is how we really feel about each other in the world. You know, they always talk about, oh, what are you using this sex scene to do? I'm using this sex scene to dissect the anatomy of hate.
Wow.
You know? So we have a lot of fun in that show. You know, there's a lot of camp elements. Bob Mackie.
What about Bob Mackie?
Well, he's very much an inspiration for me.
I love Bob Mackie.
In terms of, because Taffeta will come out and play a chandelier in the show. You know, she plays a lamppost while the boys are jacking off in the alley.
Oh,
you know,
my gosh.
She plays a tree while they are, you know, skinny dipping.
Wait, when does this open? Like, if I'm from California, if I went to California, can I see this?
Let me tell you something. Lavender Men is for everyone. Lavender Men is going to run at Skylight Theater in Los Angeles from August 6th until September the 4th.
Okay.
Live. In person.
Okay.
Then we are also going to have a streaming. They're going to be streaming performances of the show that will be accessible to a national and international audience via the internet. That the streaming showings are going to begin on August the 20th. And sales for the live showing are going to begin on June 28th. And if folks are interested in buying tickets, they can opt in now, like it's a music show. You know, people will opt in to get an alert later.
Yeah.
And there's a link in my bio on Instagram. And my Instagram is @rogerq.mason. And I'm sure you'll post this too up there, the link to my Instagram. But if you look in my bio, I have the link for people on the right-hand side of the webpage. It'll say, click for info on tickets. And you can do that now. And then the tickets will go live on the 28th of June. And we are so excited. I mean, later today, I'm going in because a play is ever evolving. So even in my most recent trip to New York, I had a couple of beautiful conversations about the play and I lived a little more and I'm going to make a couple of updates. So this is a draft that people are going to be seeing. This is not the same draft that folks saw. And I can't say too much, but you know, we're incorporating some good camp elements and there's going to be some dance and I think I'm going to be singing at some point. So we giving a show, child. It's going to be a whole thing.
So you are in it. You're in
it. Yes, I am in the show.
That's amazing.
I am in the show.
Oh, that is so amazing. I'm so excited for you, Roger.
Like, oh.
There's something that you put on your website, and sorry if I'm misquoting it. I have my notes, but I put my notes aside a long time ago at the start of this.
I said, okay.
These notes can go take a seat. You said something like, if we can dream it in the theater, we can build it in our world.
Yes. And what I mean by that is this. I'm thinking about theater as theatron. The Greek notion of the seeing place. So we come to the theater in order to see our lives reflected back to us from the stage. So anything that we hope or dream or desire or fear is possible to be seen on the stage. If I can imagine peace in the world on the stage, then it is possible for it to exist in the world.
Mm.
It is a matter of special interests, money men, civic and religious structures to start supporting the cause of peace and freedom. But it's not as if it's impossible. It is physically and socially possible. You know, what is it that John Paul Sartre said? Hell is other people. You know, but I don't believe in misanthropy. I believe in civil belligerence. I believe that we have to call people out when they are wrong and hold them accountable with an air towards their change and betterment. Not just saying, oh, I'm gonna call you out. But now that I've called you out, what are we going to do with what we have seen? We need a good old-fashioned reckoning. We need a healing. We need to get our souls washed, as August Wilson said. Mm. You got your two pennies, Mr. Citizen?
Let's go.
Because this is an adventure. You was on an adventure and you didn't even know it. That's what he says.
I'm going to be wrapping this up soon, but I just want you to know how much I admire you. And I'm listening to you so... I feel like I need to take, I'm going to have to listen back to this and take more detailed notes because you're dropping so many gems. But I, as I'm sitting here looking at you and listening to you, Roger, I just wonder like what your soul looks like, all the places you've been and before you came to this earth, because you are so special and you are here for a reason and you are living it. You're like, hey, you... use me, whatever, what, you know, I pray to God, use me. And you're being used. You are a disruptor. You are a trailblazer. And it is terrifying and exciting and thrilling. And that's me just listening to you, listening to you. I can only imagine the journey of living it, of the ups, the downs, and all of that. And I just want to encourage you to keep doing it, to keep going.
You know, it's funny. I thought about my spirit this morning, actually. And I was, because every day I take a moment to just ground and prepare for all of the things that are going to encounter me that day, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I thought about the tremendous mental energy that it takes to generate story, not only on the page, but also in life. You know, I had a conversation with folks who are auxiliary members of our production team in LA for this production of Lavender Men. And I said to them, I said, I don't want you to think that because you're here, you know, on a couple of days, that you're just coming in and collecting a check and phoning it in and just a member of the team. I said, you are a storyteller. You are just as much a part of the fabric and narrative of this program as anybody else. In fact, you're the most important. So I guess if I were to sum up what I think about every morning when I get up and I prepare my spirit to encounter myself and other people.
Come on.
You know what I think? How can I empower somebody to be their best selves? Mm. How can I empower somebody to be their best selves? It starts with me. That's the first one I've got to look at.
Yeah.
And then the next person and the next person. And you know what I've noticed more often than not, and the source of so much hate in the world, is people feel afraid, alone, and powerless.
Yeah.
So if we can just tell them, you are somebody.
Yeah. Because when people feel those things, they act out of that place.
Yeah.
And that's not good for anybody.
That's not good for anybody. And I think that's our mission collectively. And that certainly is what I'm dedicating this lifetime to.
Mm. Oh, Roger. Thank you for joining me today. You are so awesome. You're so awesome. I'm so glad that I've gotten to be exposed to you. I'm excited for Lavender Men this fall, this August and September. I'm like, yeah. If I don't make it out to California, I will be in California. But if I'm not there for those dates, I will absolutely be streaming it. And you've already told the peeps how they can find you. But what are all the rundowns? Your Instagram is?
At RogerQ.Mason is the Instagram. I don't use Twitter as much, but y'all can encourage me to by talking to me. It's at Roger Q Mason. That's the one on Twitter. And on Facebook, I'm just listed as Roger Q Mason.
What about your website? You've got a website.
Yeah, I have a website. It's RogerQMason.com. I was very lucky to get all of those identifiers together early on, so I don't have to do too much.
You are lucky because I know the girl who has at Salisha. She will not give it to me.
She's not letting you have it.
She won't let me have it. She's like, but why do you want it? I'm like, girl, don't get me started. I'm like, oh, don't do this to me.
That's funny.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Roger, for joining me. You're so awesome. And I'll let you know when this airs and all the things. So
thank you very much for having me, Salisha. You are a joy and a delight and a wonder to behold.
Oh my goodness. Oh, God bless you. Thank you so much. Oh, and happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
And that wraps another episode of Black Hair in the Big League. Y'all, I'm so honored to have such great guests on this show. And if there's somebody who you want to listen to, please drop me a note on my Instagram at Salisha Thomas or at Black Hair Podcast and slip into those DMs and let me know what you want to hear, who you want to hear from. If you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast, rate it, leave a review, tell a friend, follow us on Patreon at Black Hair in the Big Leagues. Y'all, I am so grateful that you are part of this community. It would not be the same without you. Shout out to Wilton Music for producing my theme song, Love COD. Shout out to Colin Tabor for editing this episode and most of these episodes. And shout out to you for listening. Y'all, my heart is so big and I feel so grateful. Thank you for listening to Black Hair in the Big Leagues. I'm your host, Salisha Thomas. See you next week.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.